Sunday, July 20th. Darcy here, doing our first edition of We Are Change Radio. I don't have a good title for it yet. Basically, the idea behind it is, well, during our street actions, I found that some of the conversations had with people we meet that are just so interesting, and the perspectives and interviews that you can have with the people that, you know, that you end up talking to, very, very insightful, and some of the conversations are high out there, so I'm going to be doing more interviews during our street actions. I'm actually just, finding out the, not all the information, and, Mr. told me that, he was, with me as a brother on the ground, to, says that there's not enough proper fire precautions that can be put into high-rise. Second part of the show is basically this conversation I had with Mark Shamish, talking about his daughter having to participate in school lockdown drills. Basically, he'd asked her what she knew about drills and lockdowns to prepare them for some sort of attack by a terrorist or a long-range gunman. And she says that she's drumming in the background. Actually, you can hear street noise right now because I'm on the way from Dundas to Christie Park to attend the screening of Cyrano Sir and Unfair Dealings, which is an event hosted in the park, Christie Park, by the Toronto Coalition to End the War, nowar.ca. Hopefully we can get some interviews there, so enjoy the rest of the show.
Plus I got a chain. family back then?
Yeah. Yeah? Oh, yeah.
That's about you.
Okay. Well, thanks for picking me up, mate. If you haven't looked into 9-11, there's no way that fires could have brought those buildings down in the way that they have.
On the upper floor that it had to come down.
Yeah.
And it was like a deck of cards. They found out the exact place that would be the most harm, and they hit it. They didn't just hit it once, they hit it twice. So.
But what would you say about all the dust that came about as the guys felt the buildings come down?
All the plastic materials, mostly because the Ziploc.
Thank you.
last time through?
Yeah.
What can you tell me about that?
Well, I read the code black on the website.
Yeah.
And so I said to her, I said, honey, do you have... I asked her if they have lockdowns.
How long have we been going on for? And she didn't talk about it, huh?
No, she hadn't known.
Yeah.
So she's with her mom for 2 weeks now, but next Sunday she's coming back home, so I'll talk to her more about it. But I asked her about it, and she said, yeah, it's, I think she said it's called Stranger Alert.
Stranger Alert.
I think she said.
Yeah.
And I asked her how often, and she said twice a year.
Twice a year.
What do you do? And so it's really stupid. They go stranger alert over the intercom and we all hide under our desks.
Okay. So it's not just a random, you're not told about it in advance. They just, you maybe think that it is a real stranger alert or...
I don't know. I'll get details.
Yeah. And they just hide under the desk for like an hour or something like that? That's all the training they're given? I wouldn't really call that training anyway, it doesn't prepare them or help them understand the issues. So how old is she anyway? Like 12?
No, she's 10.
She's 10, she's only 10. And twice a year, I mean, we remember fire drills, it seems pretty hard, right?
Yeah.
Line up and walk outside the building, but stranger alert. They understand that it is about, maybe some deranged gunmen coming into the school, or...
I don't know. I'll question her about it.
Yeah.
They should be teaching them how to hide under a desk. They should be teaching them how to rush the door and attack anyone who comes through it.
Well,
this happened in high school. Like, we had a kid in a class. It was a problem. In our principal, the students were waiting for the hospital.
Yeah. I remember listening to interviews on CBC, parents calling in, talking about whether they, would support these lockdown drills. We had parents calling in from kindergarten, having their kids, as early as, kindergarten age, being trained in these lockdown drills. And, I've seen videos on YouTube.
Right.
Kids just, they're like, this is lockdown, and they're just talking to their cell phone cameras. Basically just sitting at the desk looking at the wall like a big joke.
Right.
So, why are schools doing this?
They're conditioning them to be slaves.
Yeah, there's one aspect, and then basically just, fear-based conditioning, trauma-based conditioning. I guess it's not that bad in Canada. Of course, that we get, happening in the United States where we actually have cops storming into the classrooms and really terrorizing. Instilling a good mindset into the children and scaring them, is it effective in any way at all, shouldn't this be something that, that really only concerns the teachers and the police working out, coordinated between the teachers and the police?
They already have those tools, though.
Yeah.
In Canada High School, we had real or fake bombs, right?
Yeah.
They go over the intercom, they ask the teachers to go find their Hamlet books.
Hamlet books?
My teacher gets out, he fiddles around the cupboard a bit, locks the door, covers the windows.
Yeah.
And then goes on, he's got door locked. One of the kids in the class actually pulls out a Hamlet book.
Okay.
And then he's kind of, he had to, take it in the end.
So that's Hamlet is the code, they used to pull the blinds on the windows, lock the doors. Turn off the lights.
It was then.
No, it should be, if there is like a legitimate threat, they really should, I listened to an interview on a radio show, and they said that the best way that they could have prevented Virginia Tech would have been to release the fire alarm, set off all the, what do you call those things? Set off the sprinklers, turn on the fire alarm, get the fire extinguishers, and just cloud up the hallways with the dust so that the attacker couldn't see his way through. Because, obviously, like a deranged attacker needs to have, strict controls.
Right.
Because, he's psychotic enough, right? So if you made the environment more chaotic, you wouldn't be able to function very well. You definitely wouldn't be able to execute people in an orderly fashion, right? So this the caller was actually a security guard for the University of Toronto. This is just around Virginia Tech, the time of Virginia Tech. And he said the way that they handled this, you know, basically not reporting the murder scene, you know, they didn't report the campus over the campus that there's been a murder and everybody should evacuate. They covered that up. And then it took them 2 hours for them to bring the cops in, right?
Yeah.
And then in between that time, they were basically just sitting outside, you know, putting on their gear, right? Meanwhile, the killer just died, you know, just walked through the hall randomly, executed people in an orderly fashion. And had they released the turn on the sprinklers, turn on the fire alarm, had everybody sort of like, you know, run out of the building, turn up all the lights, and really make the environment very obscure for somebody to try and find a way around, would have been a much more effective way of
producing still double bleeding, because then that forces people outside.
Yeah.
Forces him outside.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then it could end up worse.
Well, I mean, how could it have ended up any worse than it already was, where he was given he wasn't given any opposition at all, and people just
correctly, because there he has freedom to just go room to room. But if you got everyone in one huge crowd outside,
I would support. I'm not particularly thrilled about having armed cops roaming the school hallways. You know, what's the poor cop gonna do day after day after day? You know, just playing with 16-year-olds, right?
Well, with how bad life, I'm not 100% against it, because it was really bad. Like, I had the weapon blocker, so I know.
Okay, so you had cops in your high school then, right?
No.
No?
We had one security guard who was basically friends with everyone.
Yeah.
Didn't do much anything.
Yeah.
He was an ex-cop.
Did you have violent cops in your school? No.
This was years
ago. They've got the schools pretty well locked down now, okay?
Yeah.
Like, when I bring my daughter to school, those doors are locked. And the kids have to line up outside.
Can you wear badges?
No, they can't go into school. Now, there's a uniform code in effect.
Yeah.
So if you're a student, you got to be in uniform.
Yeah.
Now, when the bell goes, the teacher stands at the door, opens the door from within. The doors can only be opened from within.
Okay.
And at that time, like, parents are all there, too. They're dropping their children off.
Yeah.
So the children go in, and once those doors close, that's it.
Yeah.
They're heavy-duty doors, and they're locked.
Yeah.
I can't go in. I can only go in by coming in the main entrance of the school and into the administrative office, and you have to go physically through the administrative office to get into the school where the classrooms are. Now, final door leading into the classroom area,
yeah.
If that has a locking mechanism, then a teacher you have to wear a buzzer around your neck, or the administrator has to push a button for you to go through,
right.
That basically solves your problem right there, doesn't it?
More or less, yeah. It would definitely deter anybody from trying to break in.
Someone could get access, but they'd have to make a big scene that 911 would be dialed in, like, before, like, long before the guy ever made his way to a classroom. No, not long, but before anything happened, the police would already be notified.
So is this the beginning of the lanyard camera? And there was one year they tried to get where you could have reported it. Not one person did.
Yep.
They just ignored it.
I think what's really being done here is to instill fear.
Yeah.
To create a climate of to make our children grow up being in a state of fear.
Yeah.
I think that's what it's all about. Getting everyone in the same state. A state of fear.
Well, we won't touch up on sex education at this point, but you know, there's
some media. They're basically turning into a hill where it's just total control.
Well, I'll tell you this though, this year all the 7 and 8 grade girls got HPV shots.
And like 10, 12 being vaccinated for a disease that can only be protected if the
they were getting.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Stephen Harper cut a deal with Merrick where he got $300 million from Merrick Pharmaceuticals if the Catholic school board would vaccinate all the girls. Stephen Harper basically pimped out our girls to Merrick.
Yeah, yeah. There's some news put out earlier this year, but something at U of T. Two U of T administrators came under questioning for making a mandatory, putting in a mandatory vaccination policy, and not went through proper channels. And they came under fire for that. And earlier last year, 2007, there was also remember that voting scandal where you had all those legislators voting 4 or 5 times?
Okay.
Basically just, you know, they're passing laws, two-thirds of the legislators aren't even there.
Right.
And they had more votes counted than the people that were actually in the room.
Yep.
And they have video of people reaching over.
Yep.
And voting, I guess, that multiple times.
Yeah.
And one of the laws that was passed was the drug sterile HPV mandatory vaccination program. So, you know, there's all kinds of areas to look at around Merck, HPV, biops. Don't forget that biops in in a public area, you know, when you go to get your vaccination, you talk to your doctor about it. There's enough reports out there that doctors are mainly educated and influenced through direct,
medical magazines.
Yeah.
And what the sales reps tell them.
Exactly. Yeah. That was our interview with Mark and Jeff from Toronto Change, talking about police state in the schools, stranger alerts, lone gunmen drills, done at random, having children hide under their desks. It was interesting to hear Jeff's insights into the Bring Out Your Hamlet book code word, asking teachers to lock the doors, turn off the lights, close the blinds on the windows, and basically just wait until the drill is over. You can see some videos on YouTube. There aren't too many right now, but many of them that I remember seeing were just students sitting at their desks, laughing, joking around, talking to their cell phone cameras, saying, we're conducting a terror drill right now. We're conducting a lockdown. These things are happening. CBC did a call-in talk show last winter where parents had called in saying that, many were on the fence in terms of keeping their children safe and questioning if it was appropriate to have these drills. Yeah. asking a few questions about their insights into, you know, how and why Anonymous is going after cults like Scientology. So you'll hear that coming up, and then we'll go straight to the opening lecture, the opening talk given by the presumption, the people of presumption of innocence. But then it gets into, like, I don't know, like the emotional tone scale and the whole survival.
Yeah, no,
that, you know, that might have made sense in the 70s, but that's so mainstream, like, popularized today that, like, people don't really care. So I don't see, like, Scientology as doing a whole lot in terms of growing.
Well, yeah, no, in terms of, like, stats or
generating interest.
Yeah, no, like basically it's a pyramid scheme.
Yeah.
That loses members as it goes along. So it's not like they can ever hold a religious audience.
Yeah.
They're gonna gain members and they're gonna lose members at approximately the same rate. It's not like it's gonna get any larger than it is or get that much smaller. It's completely unsustainable in terms of the business practice if you look at it. Like,
yeah.
What they ask the parishioners to do and what they have to commit financially. But it's unstable enough that it has room to grow as it loses members. So
I see what Anonymous is doing is effective with the protesting. Like, the hacking is cool, but with the protesting, you're just going to discourage them from inviting more people into, you know, so, if, you know, I've seen on a weekday, there's two or three people out there. I've seen, you know, I walk by that area. I see on the weekends, you guys have some pretty big turnouts. Wasn't yesterday the, no, it was last Saturday that you had another international day.
Yeah, well, we're doing them once a month now.
What kind of?
Well, it's summer, right? I mean, we don't keep accurate track of, you know, who's doing what. But from our own little unofficial census, we're mostly college students.
Yeah.
We're mostly either U of T or Ryerson or York University students.
Some of us are a little older.
So a lot of people have been away for the summer.
Yeah.
Because they're from the suburbs or whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've dropped down to about usually between 50 and 100 people for protest now.
But we try to keep in mind that smaller numbers means that we're more approachable to the general public.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we had a huge problem. But this is one of the problems we had. Our largest protest was in March. We had like 300 people on the street there. And the police sort of went overboard with the riot control response.
Yeah.
And they had us all crammed up on that.
Individuals who are just walking by.
I know. What we had to do in April was we had to split up the protest into two groups and, you know, come in for, like, a shift because it was just too big. But we're expecting attendance to go up in, like, September, October.
Why do you think, is it just a trend that that people are catching on to, you know, the whole anonymous meme, or do you think that people are, like, really legitimately concerned with cults?
I think it's a combination of, I mean...
A lot of us are doing it because we are legitimately concerned with... Not just Scientology, but the
core.
Yeah.
The core group that are organizing and coming out and flyering and, you know, getting our PR website set up and, you know, running those operations, they're the ones that are legitimately concerned. There's a whole bunch of people that are just doing it to participate in, you know, like a social action kind of movement, but, you know, it's really hard to say. I mean, we don't...
If you guys kept it up, you probably could close. Are there any cases that you know in other cities where...
A lot of countries are actually ahead of us in terms of what they're doing in Israel. The parliament is investigating it.
There has been a significant drop in the sales
That's another thing. One of the really interesting things we've got going on in Toronto is we have several people in the building that are with us, and we're getting all their staff emails that are going in and out. So we get a copy of every communication that goes in and out of that building.
Yeah.
So we've been tracking them financially, and they're doing really poorly. That's one of the things
they're overworked, they're underpaid, and they're...
And on top of that, they're overdue on their mortgage.
Oh, yeah.
And they have floods in the GTA, as well as a number of satellite businesses.
The real issue is we can destroy them financially if we just keep it up.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we've got smaller groups, you know, maybe 10 people coming up, but we're doing it, like... 2-3 times a week now. Mm-hmm.
And also with the smaller groups, it's mostly the people who are much more serious who are coming out.
But it's getting really interesting. What we're doing right now is during Gay Pride Week, we had a little...
Were you there on Pride?
No, I was working on Pride.
Yeah,
I wanted to go.
I
wanted to go so bad, but I was working.
Oh, it was horrible. It was so crowded.
I know.
I'm really claustrophobic, so I'm there like the whole time. I'm like, please take a flyer, don't touch me.
I found these types of, like, I mean, we could have been, but I found that, like, sporting events, concerts, parades, they're not a great place to try and hand out any type of information.
What we're considering, like,
even though there's numbers,
is, hitting word on the street.
Yeah.
I'm looking to see if I get a table.
Yeah.
But we figure if we can put together some booklets, that'll be a great place to reach more people who will actually want to.
The big operation we're trying.
Just taking it because someone thought it and held it.
The big operation we're trying to do right now is we're using your anti-gay material to raise awareness. One of the things.
Scientology anti-gay.
Yeah, Scientology anti-gay.
Not our.
Of course.
Yeah. No.
Just to clarify that.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a.
They've written a number of things, and it's in Dianetics too on how homosexuality is mental illness and how covert hostility and 1.1 and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So we've actually sort of been making the rounds on the gay blogs and some of the village newspapers and things. We had an article last week on the front page of Extra or something.
I think it was.
About us and about how they're anti-gay. What we're trying to do is we're trying to convince the Toronto Police to approach it from a hate crimes perspective because they're not a recognized religion in Canada.
Yeah.
But their books are actively promoting violence against gays. It's not just like gays are mentally ill.
Yeah.
It actually says they should be destroyed or they can't be cured.
Yeah.
So that's what we're trying to convince the Toronto Police and city councilors we've been in contact.
So how are you doing that?
We're sending out emails. We made a promotional video talking about Scientology and homosexuality.
Which you can find on YouTube, and it's a very good
video. Yeah.
Very much so.
The founder's son, one of Hubbard's sons, was actually gay.
Yeah.
And that sort of drove him mad.
Well, yeah, I mean, Hubbard himself is just a black hole of scandal.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. he tortured his wife. He brainwashed his son. Didn't he have a daughter that, she was raped or something like that?
Supposedly had a harem of 13-year-old girls when he was on the high seas.
Yeah. And then if you look a little further into it, you can see that he was actually, I can't confirm this because I don't have the information, but he was associated with the OTO, like Aleister Crowley.
Yeah, that's another thing.
And then it goes into the black arts and black magic, because I see Scientology as, you know, the big secret behind it, you know, the whole, like, science fiction aspect of it is one aspect of it, but what it really is this one of many types of corporate clubs, whatever, that actually uses ritual, like black magic ritual, but it's veiled in science fiction terms.
Well, that's one thing we noticed. We've been doing a lot of...
Can you do comparisons between the black magic rituals and what Scientology does in terms of the trance state and the suggestions and what handles things?
Yeah, we've been doing some interviews with Scientologists. A few unofficial interviews with people that are actively working in Scientology organizations on their religious history.
Yeah.
And a lot of them have been involved in either Wicca or Kabbalah
not to be disrespectful of these respective.
Yeah, but these are people that are looking for sort of a new age kind of spiritual movement to come to.
Right. They shop around.
They're sort of, you know, religious shoppers.
They look for the thrill. They're chasing the...
Or answers.
Yeah.
People will go to whoever they think has the answers, or whoever, you know, argues the most convincingly that they have the answers.
You know, I've had a little bit of experience with these organizations that conduct, I guess, awareness training kind of thing. It was big in the 70s. There's a movie called Century of the Self that is very interesting. If you guys look that up on Google. Real eye-opener to... I'm not sure Scientology is specifically mentioned, but these types of new age kind of spiritual / NLP groups really came up about it. It was like a really profitable little trend happening then. So that really details some of the history of these 70s New Age movements that came about.
Yeah.
So you definitely want to look at that. But have you guys done any...
What was it called again?
Century of the Self.
Century of the Self.
I think the director's name was Adam... I can't remember his last name, but he's a BBC documentary. And it's in three parts. So you get the whole gamut of a lot of things. But have you guys looked into Freemasonry?
Myself, no.
Yeah. Not much.
Because you know that's all around. You know that that's on government buildings. You know that.
Yeah, I've read a couple of conspiracy theories on, you know, how Masonic symbols are.
American dollar bills.
Yeah, American dollar bills.
Yeah.
Not much.
The Capitol building, all that kind of stuff.
Well, you know the levels of graduation that people have to get through different rituals. Very, very, very similar structure to the stages of training that we get for Scientology.
Yeah.
It's all very interesting stuff, and I think that, you know, one piece of advice that I would give to Anon is, from an outsider's perspective, is look into what, if you guys aren't already, look into what the experience is of somebody who's trapped inside Scientology.
Yeah.
For example, I believe that a lot of people enjoy participating in Scientology, even if it's, you know, very costly, even if it does separate them from the rest of the world. They do get some sort of pleasure out of, you know, the reverie states that they get from conducting these audits. But, you know, it's being shown in more and more in the news that it's very destructive.
Yeah.
Still, people stay on, hang on to it because they have family, they have friends inside the Church of Scientology, and maybe their allegiance isn't to the Church itself. Maybe they're trying to make the church better from within because they have, you know, like they have emotional connections with people inside, and they don't want to leave because they know that if they walk out, they'll never be admitted back in, or it'll be, you know, I've seen a few interviews with people who tried to leave. They stayed in the church because they couldn't afford to leave. They weren't there.
They hit you with the freeloader's bill.
Yeah.
After you, if you're on staff and you're living in the building,
yeah.
They'll retroactively charge you for room and board.
Right.
for all the years you've been working on staff if you blow.
So these people, you know, you should approach your protests. If you're trying to get people to speak out against Scientology, because I'm sure that there are many people that can share some very interesting stories. I've read some interesting stories in the forums of, you know, what do you call it? Little punishment things that they get if they screw up. If they screw up, they get beat up. So I'm sure that people could speak out about a lot of different horror stories, but, you know, staff acting out of line, mistreating customers, ripping people off, and, you know, but you have to kind of come from it from the perspective that, you know, the people inside Scientology, they need a lot of care, they need a lot of compassion, they need a lot of, they need to give the opportunity to speak out, as opposed to be ridiculed for being sucked into it. And, you know, it'd be interesting to find out how people got into it and why they were brought into it. I think that, you know, what we're seeing with people in today's Scientology are like second generation Scientologists. It's not like it's got the same recruitment power as it does here in Toronto, may have before.
We've been in contact with, we've got two individuals inside the Toronto org that are trying to approach, you know, leaving and just trying to get themselves set up. But from what they're telling us is it's pretty much the hardcore dedicated people that are the ones trying to handle us.
Yeah.
I mean, like, they're not letting anyone that could possibly be on the fence any sort of contact with us. I mean,
except for Winston. Oh, he's a thought crime favorite?
Yeah? Are you serious?
Not actually her boyfriend. He's the one who gets in shit every time when she walks by and he stares at her ass and like smiles at her.
Oh, is he that?
I mean, sales guy, right?
So you guys have been around the org to know who the regulars are, who come
in. Yeah.
We know most of them, yeah.
Yeah. Are they good people? Are they nice people?
Some of them are less, very much.
Well, some of them are just yes men. Like, they're just yes men.
Yeah.
And then there's Mario and Mario
Zed.
And Toronto Change, we are Change Toronto, TorontoChange.com. This is just a free catalog from Global Outlook. It's just information about the 9/11 books, some good articles about you know, the wars and stuff. That's what you guys check out. And when's your next 16th thing that you're promoting?
That's the 16th.
August
16th. Big one. We
usually do one every couple days.
Yeah.
Thursday, Saturday.
Oh,
the typical
day. Yeah. Well, it'd be interesting to see how it progresses. And I'd like to see Anna look into not just Scientology. Scientology is one of many different. And if you watch Century of the Self, it kind of opens your eyes to what else is out there and how someone.
Well, if we ever do progress onto different issues. Broadly, because the presumption of innocence is something that affects us all, it's something that
aware that despite the fact that the prosecution state is falling apart, however, the young men and boys who are part of this have months and even years of incarceration before they're going to get their day in court. And three of them are in solitary confinement in cells that measures 4 by 6 by 8 feet. And it's very difficult, I think, for us to understand what it's like to live in those conditions for any amount of time, but imagine spending 2 years, more than 2 years in those conditions. Unfortunately, we're not able to show you tonight a model of the solitary confinement cell, which was constructed by Alan Rowe, who's an activist and artist who's also here tonight. Because of the rain, we weren't able to set it up. But it gives you a sense of what it's like to be in those conditions, and it's going to be displayed in various parts of the city in the next little while. But tonight, you will get a chance to see the film that tells the story of the Toronto 18, and also to hear from one of the very courageous family members of the Toronto 18, who's going to tell you a little bit about what it's like to live in these conditions of living in Toronto 18 city in this way. So I think I'm Mohammed is at Mop now, and thank you, Lourdes and Mark, on this day, encouraging you to take a look at the literature on the table over here, in particular the sign petition, demanding an end to solitary confinement. Because if it takes another 2 years for people to have their day in court and they spend another 2 years in solitary, that's something that affects you for the rest of your life, and it's something that is not going in this country. So please do sign the petition, and with that, I will introduce Fahima Mohammed.
While coming home after grocery shopping, and my father was
sold by someone at Marston who wants to play wooden mill about it firsthand. So anyway, when he came home, we were all in a state of shock. We didn't know what was going on. We didn't know why Sahin was arrested. We didn't know where they had taken him or anything. And so we were worried about my other two brothers. And so when they came, they asked for all the men to vote. And so my father was supposed to go. And other than pulling my father by his collar and asking him to put down his weapon, when I looked at my father's hand, I saw a few sheets of paper in the pen. And the officer yelled at my father saying, put down your weapons. And I said, what weapons are you talking about? We only have some papers in his hand. And with all of them pointing guns towards us and at my father, like, what did they expect him to do? So they pulled him out of his collar and they took him away for questioning. And the rest of us were asked to come out one by one. I have two other sisters, and Sahin's wife, who's a sister, has two babies. And it was raining that night, so we're all asked to come out. We're standing out in the rain with my mother. My mother and my sisters weren't allowed to even put their shoes on. And so we're standing outside until like 2 a.m. And so finally, they let us go to our neighbor's house and to spend the night. And I remember asking one of the senior LCMP officers about my brother, who was 17 at that time. He was supposed to come home at 11 from work, and he hadn't showed up, so he started getting worried, and he thought maybe we took him away as well. And so around 2:30 a.m., the RCMP officer told me that they had actually arrested my brother. So we spent the night away at our neighbor's house. We didn't know what to do. We didn't know who to call. We didn't know how to deal with lawyers or anything. It was just such a sudden shock for us. And my father, he was so paralyzed. He didn't know how to react to it. He was quiet the whole night. He didn't say a word. And so this morning, we got one of our friends to take us to the court. We were able to get a hold of a lawyer for my brother and my brother-in-law. The next morning, I remember my brother-in-law, my brother calling us and telling us that he was being held with the other guys, some of whom were his friends, at a police station in Peel Region, and he didn't know exactly where he was. But he told us that he was okay, even though I could hear a quiver in his voice, and I knew that he was hurt, that they had hurt him, that he was only trying to be strong for us. The next day, I remember seeing him in court. They were courted in groups of five. My brother was shackled. His feet were shackled with four of the other accused, and his hands were handcuffed with four of the other accused. And that's how they were all brought in. And at that time, my brother and some of the friends, they tried to look at us to smile and just to show us that, you know, they were okay, that we just had to be strong. And even that was something the guards didn't like, and they tried to stop that, and it was very harsh with them. And it felt like, you know, my brother was under their control, and they could do anything they wanted to him, and we couldn't do anything about it. So Sahin, Ahmed, and Ali J, and Zakari Amara, they have spent over 2 years in solitary confinement at the Don jail. And when I say solitary confinement, what it means is that you're basically locked up in a cell that's 6x4x10, 24 hours a day. At first it was 23 and a half, and now 24 hours a day. They have very limited human contact. The only human contact that you have is the two visits that you have with your family per week, two visits per week. They're allowed to call every day, around the day, 20 minutes per day. Other than that, they're allowed to leave their cells every other day, only for 20 minutes for showers. They're not allowed to go to the yard. They don't have any yard time. They don't have any educational material. They're required to send them books.
but they never had access to them. And which name surprises me, because someone like convicted and sadistic murderer like Carla Homolka can have access to education. And she completed her sociology courses to Queen's University, to Queen's College, and she was convicted murderer. So why aren't these guys who should be presumed innocent are being treated as though they've been convicted already?
Zephyr
Amara recently wrote a public letter in which he said, whenever I was moved out of myself, I was required to tie my hands to the hatch of the door before it was opened in order to be handcuffed. To do this, I had to kneel on both knees. Many times when I put my hands through the hatch, the guards would forcefully pull my wrists so that my forehead would slam against the metal door. Whenever the guards came in to collect garbage, they would often apply wrestling maneuvers on me for the purpose of entertaining themselves. They would sometimes apply pressure on sensitive areas such as my temple and fingers. One day when I came back from court, a guard twisted my hands above my head, forcing me to sit on one foot back to myself. Similarly, my brother shared his experience in solitary confinement with me. He said it was the first night, he said, when I got out of the car, out of the police car, I was surrounded by police dogs, blocking, and from far I could see bright camera flashes and reporters screaming. I went inside and I was strip-searched, and for the first time in my life I felt so humiliated. Then I was put in a cell for about 5 hours or so, so it was early morning, and the whole night I couldn't sleep because of the cold concrete bench, and there was no water, so I was really thirsty. But when I would ask for water or my third bag, so at least I could sleep, they just say this is not an effing hotel. He told me how the thing he hated the most was dealing with the SWAT team. They would throw him on the ground, shackle him, handcuff him, and then make him crawl all the way to his cell. This is repeated with all the guys who were minors at that time. One of them was actually 16. For the first 3 days, they had no water, no toilet paper, just a cold cell room with a concrete bench and no pillows or blankets. The windows were covered so that they couldn't see outside the door or window. He was kept in solitary confinement for almost 2 months until he was released on bail under strict conditions. He further said, when I was released after 3 months, I was so happy to be back with my family, but the houseless conditions that were put on me didn't make it any different than being in solitary confinement under maximum security. That went on for a year, and in that time, I had given my family a very hard time. I couldn't go to sleep at night without taking my antidepressants. I couldn't talk to anyone for more than half an hour without losing my temper. I couldn't have more than 3 people around me because it would get hard for me to sleep. And this is something that Fahim has been complaining about since he started to get very claustrophobic as well. I get angry at something I don't even remember, but then I black out, and 20 minutes later there'll be broken furniture around me. Yes, I have unified conscious symptoms. I'm told that I have post-traumatic stress syndrome and that I was prescribed antidepressants. I didn't go through any treatment simply because I was told that whatever I'm going through will stop as soon as I'm out on bail. But now I'm released from bail and I barely have any condition. But nothing much has changed. I'm still not even close to being the same person I was 2 years ago. I'm a completely different person. Someone who keeps asking himself if he's really gone crazy. I suffer from memory loss sometimes. After I came out from jail, a lot of my old friends came up to me and I could barely remember any of them. And that was something that really scared me because I had been to school with these people. And even for a good couple of years, but I couldn't even remember their names. A lot of things had changed in me, and I feel that nightmares were the times I was inside. I still have my anger problems and sleeping disorder, and because of all of this, I've lost my respect among my friends and other people that know me. people don't look at me as they look at a normal teenager. Either they're really scared of me, or they feel really sorry for me that they end up looking at me like I'm just a crazy person. According to the Minister of Correctional Services, the Correctional Services Division supervises the detention and release of inmates within a social environment that's designed to encourage changes in attitude. The division also provides training, treatment, and related services designed to create opportunities for successful personal and social adjustment in the community. So my question is, what has the Dawnville or the Maplehurst correctional facility done to ensure that they get this kind of environment? Instead, they have limited their human contact. They have deprived them of a very fundamental right. They have basically no educational material. They have and one of the things that upsets me the most is that they don't have touch visits. It's been 2 years since they've been able to touch their family members. It's been 2 years since Benjamin has been able to hug his children. And for the past 3 years, they've continued to be treated like this unjustly for no reason. And my brother, he was labeled as a terrorist. 2 months later, they let him go without an apology. But they ruined his life. They left his life. And he will never be the same person. So these guys have been there for 2 years. What is there are in the end after a trial, and God knows when the trial will start, after the trial, if they are found innocent, what about the candidates spent there in Salt Lake and Fund? Are they going to be able to give them that back? Their lives have basically been limited to a full concrete bench with no sunlight, no nothing, no human contact. I was actually reading about a correctional center here in Canada, a thing called the Bathroom Correctional Center. It's the only jail in the whole world where inmates are allowed to have weapons. They can go for hunting. Of course, they have to be escorted with guards, but they can go for hunting. And it surprised me. I mean, we are not asking for our brothers to be treated as royalty. We're simply asking for humane treatment, which is their right as Canadian citizens. And so I was just going to request you all to please look into this case, to look into their lives and judge for yourself, and forget about whether they're guilty or innocent. Forget about everything. Just all I'm asking for is for you to look into this as a human being, as their next door neighbor, and judge for yourself. Look into the cases as everything has been coming out of me, even if you don't go to court, if you all have to pick up your papers and go to Mail Front Star, everything's out of the paper. And so, judge for yourself, and all I'm asking for.
was testimony given by a woman by the name of Sima, who is a family member of one of the falsely accused and imprisoned men, young Muslim boy, part of the Toronto 18, giving testimony about the harsh, unfair, cruel living conditions that her brother endured while being tried for charges of terrorism. He and many others were subjected to solitary confinement for up to 500 days. That's 10 times the legal limit that is sanctioned by the United Nations as humane. So these men, many of which have all been released without charge brought against them, had to endure very painful, psychologically harmful conditions living in these cells, and were also subjected to physical abuse through the guards. So that was her account, her testimony of how hard it's been for her brother to readjust and move on with his life after being released. Before that was Chantal Sondrum, and she is one of the organizers of the Presumption of Innocence Project. You can find out more at presumptionsofinnocence.ca. More information can be found about this case at captivecanada.com and toronto18.com. Also, please do watch the movie Unfair Dealings on Google. It's a documentary that will lay out all the details of this story, and it's important that you look into these issues, because it really exposes the false terror threat here in Canada. It really shows who the individuals are inside the government, inside the Conservative Party in Canada, that are orchestrating the false case against these men. It shows how the intelligence agencies like CSIS and RCMP had a very weak case against against the young men who were completely innocent. It was a total frame-up. You can also find a great article written by a Canadian professor, Michael Kiefer. Just search for the frame-up of the Toronto 18 by Professor Michael Kiefer, and please do also go to thestar.ca and read articles by Thomas Walkham, who has been the most fair reporter to give coverage to this particular story happening here in Toronto as of this very moment. Three of the originally 18 falsely accused and illegally detained men still remain in jail, and their cases being stalled. It's a great cost, a great financial burden for the families, and the family members, the ones speaking out against this are asking all of us to first become informed and then to take action by writing to people like our Minister of Security, Stockholm Day, that we know we know what they did, and we're just appalled and disgusted by it. So please do visit torontochange.com if you'd like to support us in creating visibility and creating awareness around this case. Please do watch the movie Unfair Dealings, and please please pass this information on to him. Thank you. This has been a broadcast. brought to you by We Are Change Toronto at torontochange.com. My name is Darcy. Thanks for listening. Take care.